Corticosterone knocked out the thyroid hormone completely, which is why those tadpoles didn't grow and develop to the metamorphosis stage. Corticosterone also affects the production of surfactant, which plays a key role in lung development, allowing them to absorb oxygen out of the air. Because I was on the pre-med track, I had learned in anatomy and physiology how hormones work together in a kind of symphony of homeostasis, the body's biological balance or equilibrium. But it wasn't until I worked in the Hayes lab that I really got it. The unlucky frog served as a critical object lesson. If you have the right amount of each hormone, they all work together to keep the body functioning normally. But if you change one of those levels, the delicate interplay gets thrown off. This kind of hormonal imbalance can have direct and indirect effects. For instance, an increase in corticosteroids can directly affect blood pressure. But it can also indirectly affect growth and development by altering how other hormones do their jobs. How hormones affect one another, and, as a result, the human body, can be complicated. But it's hugely important. Another eye-opener for me at the Hayes Lab was the compulsory evolutionary stress response primer that everyone got on the first day of work. It's easy, kind of, to memorize the impacts of various hormone interactions in the body. If A and B, then C. Science in school is a never-ending pageant of flowcharts, infographics, formulas, and calculations. The what of the human body, if you will. Looking at the biology from an evolutionary perspective, as Hayes tadpoles taught us to do, we got something just as important. The why. Most of us came in with an understanding of the biological cause and effect of the physiological processes in an ideal, adaptive state. We left with a fascination for decoding the cause and effect in a far-from-ideal, maladaptive state. For most of early human history, the biggest stressors, stress-inducing events, were predators, short-term stressors, and food shortages, long-term stressors. Back in the day on the savanna, a major purpose of cortisol was to help the body manage that long-term stress. Maintaining homeostasis is the key to survival. So cortisol shows up when the body detects a change in the environment that threatens to push it off balance. With a shortage of supermarkets and iPhone apps in prehistoric Africa, early humans spent most of their days finding food, killing food, and preparing food for eating. When times were tough, the body would detect a lack of nutrients and begin the chain reaction that is the stress response. One of the biggest parts of this process is the increased production of cortisol, and a major effect of cortisol is an increase in blood sugar. The brain needs enough blood sugar to be able to think and plan, so this extra punch of cortisol helps to keep blood sugar on an even keel, despite the shortage of gazelle barbecue. The steady stream of glucose swimming in your veins also helps fuel your muscles, so in the event that you do see a gazelle, you have the energy to chase it down. Cortisol also helps to maintain normal blood pressure by regulating the body's water and salt levels. And it inhibits growth and reproduction, because if you're living through a food crisis, it's not a good time to be doing any optimistic long-term family planning. It makes more sense to divert all available energy to the problem at hand. Cortisol has these effects and more. And not just when there's a lack of food, but also when there's a physical threat, lions for instance, an injury, or an environmental stressor, earthquake. Every time the stress response gets triggered, the same basic biological process kicks in. The difference between the ancient adult human surviving a bad hunting season and the tadpole getting a lethal dose of stress is the timing and duration of the exposure to the stress hormone. In the case of the hunter, the process was adaptive, good for survival, because it happened in adulthood. In the case of the tadpole, the process was maladaptive, bad for survival because it happened in childhood, or tadpolehood, too early in development. In the days following my initial visit with Diego, I thought about the Hayes Lab a lot, what I'd learned about the stress response, what I'd learned about development, and what I'd learned about how to creatively approach a problem. The last part is what stayed with me as I reviewed Hayes's old research paper on corticosterone and its role in metamorphosis. But while the tadpoles and toads gave me a solid appreciation for how stress hormones can affect development, I recognized that these were animal studies. The tadpoles were given significant doses of corticosterone, and as a result, the effects were dramatic. That made sense, but like a lot of animal studies, there was no guarantee that it would translate directly to humans. And no one tried the experiment on humans, owing to the small ethical problem of giving people massive doses of stress hormones. So there were no studies evaluating the effects of massive doses of stress hormones on humans, let alone children. Or were there? I was a third-year resident working in the pediatric intensive care unit, PICU, at Lucile Packard's Children's Hospital at Stanford. And Sarah P. was a beautiful 6-year-old girl who woke up one morning paralyzed from the waist down. After an extensive workup, we finally determined the cause. ADEM, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. ADEM is a rare autoimmune disease in which the body's immune system attacks myelin, the insulating sheaths that surround nerve fibers and allow nerve impulses to travel quickly throughout the body. Sarah's parents were understandably terrified. The treatment for ADEM is high doses of the steroid prednisone, which is essentially a synthetic version of cortisol. The hope is that the stress dose of steroids will suppress the misguided immune system so that nerve function will recover. As I was writing the order for the prednisone, my supervising physician reminded me to also write what doctors call standing orders. This is an automatic protocol put in place for every time a particular medication is given. For stress doses of steroids, standing orders addressed what to do if Sarah P. had any of the predictable side effects. In the pediatric ICU, decades of experience have shown physicians that most patients who get high doses of prednisone have the same types of problems. So the standing order goes something like this. 1. If blood pressure reaches X, then give Y blood pressure medication. 2. If blood sugar goes above X, start insulin drip at Y rate. 3. If the patient becomes psychotic and tries to rip out her IV, give X antipsychotic at Y dosage. When I got to this particular part of memory lane, I couldn't help yelling, "Rotted!" Jamaican patois for, oh my goodness. I realized that the effects of a stress dose of steroids on a child were not only known, but codified in the hospital's protocols for care. Medical protocols are put in place when the side effects of a certain medication are so predictable that it's worth setting up a system for addressing them. This is one of those unique scenarios where clinical experience becomes living research. The doctors at Stanford observed the side effects that patients who received stress doses of steroids exhibited. Then they investigated what they thought was going on and made adjustments to care until they found the best way to treat those side effects. It may not be ethical to run a premeditated, independent experiment to test how human children react to stress hormones, but observing their reaction during the course of life-saving treatment certainly is. Over time, the successful interventions that doctors implemented became the clinical guidelines for managing the side effects of prednisone. Sarah P. was a lucky beneficiary of this, getting enough medicine for her to improve and recover, I'm thankful to say. But not so much that it created larger problems for her. Suddenly, my patient's physical reactions didn't seem so crazy. If their systems were flooded with stress hormones, like Sarah's or the tadpoles, it stood to reason that their bodies, including their blood pressure, blood sugar, and neurological functions, might react in similar ways. All could be seen as side effects of stress hormones. It made biological sense that a high dose of stress hormones at the wrong developmental stage could have an outsized impact on my patient's downstream health. It was exactly what happened to the younger tadpoles versus the closer to metamorphosis froglets. The difference between adaptive and maladaptive reactions is all about the when. An extreme example of timing when it comes to hormones is a condition called hypothyroidism. Many of us know someone or have heard of someone who has an underactive thyroid. It basically means that the thyroid gland isn't producing enough thyroid hormone, so a person's metabolism slows down and he or she develops dry skin, brittle hair, and the most well-known symptom, weight gain. While somewhere around 10 million adults have this condition, it often takes a long time to diagnose it. But the good news is that symptoms in adults tend to be relatively minor, and the treatment is readily available. When hypothyroidism occurs in infancy, though, it's a whole different ballgame. The condition, once cruelly called cretinism, can result in significantly impaired physical and mental growth. Generations of children suffered severe symptoms because physicians caught the disorder too late. But now, newborns are screened for hypothyroidism. When identified early, the condition is easily treated with thyroid hormone, which means cretinism is now extremely rare in the developed world. But it's still a great example of just how critical timing is. A lack of thyroid hormone in the body has wildly different effects depending on when it happens. In adulthood, it's minor and treatable. In childhood, it's profound. When it came to Diego, the timing of his symptoms worried me. I feared that the dose of stress he had experienced was high enough to overload his system and that it might be the underlying cause of his symptoms. The same went for my other patients. But what about the rest of the community? Plenty of the adult population had experienced adversity and trauma on par with Diego's during their own childhoods. Because my patients were kids, I found out about the trauma they had experienced through their parents or caregivers. Often the parents had experienced far more adversity than the children they were bringing into clinic. The moms, dads, aunties, and uncles I came to know over the years periodically shared their own histories of being physically, verbally, or sexually abused, growing up with domestic violence, or even witnessing someone get stabbed or shot. Now they had arthritis, failing kidneys, heart disease, chronic lung disease, and cancer. Most had grown up in Bayview or similar communities, and I couldn't help but wonder about the long-term effects these early experiences had had on the health of entire generations. There was no question that the people of Bayview, my patients included, experienced higher doses of stress than your average American. I thought about little Sarah P. and the standing orders for the steroid side effects. If the adults of Bayview were once children who experienced stress doses of hormones during the critical stages of development, what were the side effects that we could see as a result? The answer was right there in the 2004 community health assessment I'd read on my first day of work. There are thousands of Bayviews all over the United States, not to mention the globe. In public health school, I'd heard lectures about the extent of health disparities between vulnerable communities, such as those with high percentages of low income, recent immigrants, or communities of color, and wealthier neighborhoods. And as a black woman from an immigrant family in America, I felt like I was being told that water is wet. What I was looking for was the why. I had a distinct memory of sitting in Professor Ichiro Kawachi's classroom in Boston as he presented some striking data about obesity rates in high-risk communities and asking myself, could this be related to cortisol? Is it possible that the daily threat of violence and homelessness breathing down your neck is not only associated with poor health, but potentially the cause of it? It occurred to me, horribly, that people living in crowded public housing in Chicago might not be all that different from tadpoles living in a shrinking pond. But now, sitting in Bayview, I saw that what people experienced in childhood could be enough to set them on a devastating medical trajectory. The very idea that the events of childhood could affect people's health for the rest of their lives was scary. But if the stress response system was indeed the mechanism in play, it opened up a huge runway for change. It meant that if we figured out the problem early enough in a child's development, we could make a significant impact on his or her later life. Length of exposure and timing were both critical when it came to the effects of corticosterone on the tadpoles. With the kids of the Stanford PICU, we knew that there were measures that we could take to address the side effects of stress hormones before they caused a problem. Could my colleagues and I create a standing order for patients like Diego? What would that look like? I didn't know, but the thought was enough to fill me with the same kind of electricity that I felt as a kid when I was working on a problem with my dad, and I could sense that I was on the right track. Chapter 3, 40 Pounds. The beauty and the challenge of working in a clinic like mine was that regardless of your own needs, sleep, or desires, lunch, there was an undertow of urgency that always pulled you back to your patients. After work, I sometimes had the luxury of time to investigate the connection between adversity and health. But when I was in the clinic, I had a stack of charts and a waiting room full of sick kids. With Diego in particular, I felt that familiar tug. While I had written him prescriptions for an inhaler and eczema medication, I still needed to tackle the growth arrest. I enlisted the help of Dr. Bhatia once again. I wondered if a course of hormonal therapy might be necessary, but she reminded me that Diego's labs hadn't shown hormonal imbalances, or at least none we could measure. Her experience was that in cases such as these, medication likely wouldn't help. To my surprise, she said the most effective type of treatment for Diego was talk therapy. Luckily, I already had someone to turn to. The Bayview Child Health Center had received a small grant for patient support services, and when it came to figuring out what to do with it, I knew just who to ask. The community itself. I understood from my training that building relationships in underserved communities is important for improving health outcomes, which is why I made it part of my work to help schools and churches plan health fairs, nutrition programs, and asthma prevention classes. Folks got used to seeing my face in the neighborhood. Many well-meaning people had come and gone in Bayview, leaving a multitude of unfulfilled promises in their wake. But the community was beginning to believe me when I said I was committed to improving the health of their children. When the grant money for patient support arrived, the answer regarding how to spend it was clear: mental health services. Though at the time, it was pretty unusual for a pediatric office to have a therapist on staff, my colleagues and I knew enough to give the members of the community what they said they needed, not what we thought they needed. But I was nervous about finding the right person to fill the therapist position. We were a nonprofit health center in the middle of Bayview Hunters Point, with minimal staff and budget, and plenty of intense, unpaid overtime to go around. While that kind of work might have been my idea of a dream job, I wasn't crazy enough to think it was everybody's. When Dr. Whitney Clark walked into my office for an interview, my hopes fell. Even though I certainly knew enough not to judge someone by outward appearances, I still thought, there's no way this is the guy. It would be an understatement to say that someone who looks like Dr. Clark is not the first image to come to mind when you think of a therapist working in a community like Bayview. He's male, he's white, and he's a dead ringer for Chris Pine, the actor who plays young Captain Kirk in the new Star Trek films. Basically, he's a walking Abercrombie and Fitch ad, which to me meant that patients would have trouble trusting him and connecting with him. Something of a problem for a therapist in a marginalized, high-needs community. But after we talked for a long time, my initial skepticism started to thaw, and I saw something in him that I had a hunch my patients would respond to. Most of my patients, predictably, pushed back when I referred them to Dr. Clark. "I'm not taking my child to a white therapist," was a common and understandable refrain. These families were in a vulnerable place, and many had experienced the kind of institutionalized racism that breeds a deep mistrust of outsiders and a reflexive defensiveness. Luckily, by then I had built a strong enough relationship with the community that when I vouched for Dr. Clark and said I thought he could make a huge difference for their kids, they trusted me. It was never long before they saw him for who he was, a fiercely caring, easy-to-talk-to, skilled practitioner who quickly became a sort of haven for them. I always loved it when these patients' families saw me again months later, glowing with a kind of pride about him. Soon, they were vouching for him, too. After talking with Dr. Bhatia about Diego, I brought Dr. Clark up to speed and asked what type of therapy plan we should recommend for him. Soon, we had connected Rosa with a Spanish-speaking therapist who was experienced in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, TFCBT for short, a clinical protocol designed to address the impact of trauma on a child's development by working with both parent and child. With that knocked off of my endless to-do list, I felt better. But although Diego was now on the best treatment plan we could devise, I was still frustrated. I was seeing more and more clearly in my patients a connection between adversity and poor health, but I felt totally unprepared to deal with it. While I was grateful for Dr. Bhatia's guidance regarding Diego's growth, there were many other times when I had no one to call. The previous decade of experiences had led me to trust that what I was seeing was real. But if it was true, why hadn't I learned how to treat it in medical school or residency? Where were the clinical protocols? Where were the committee's recommendations to doctors about what to do about this? Whitney Clark was often a sounding board for my frustration. Time and again, we talked about my hypothesis that adversity was at the root of both the mental health symptoms that he was treating and my most vexing medical cases. Despite his lack of background in endocrinology, it made perfect sense to him. He even reminded me of a few other extreme cases that we'd come up against that fit the Diego stress symptom mold. A couple of months later, Dr. Clark came into my office and handed me a research paper with a big smile on his face. "Have you seen this?" he asked. It was a 1998 article in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Relationship of childhood abuse and household dysfunction to many of the leading causes of death in adults. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study by Dr. Vincent Felitti, Dr. Robert Onda, and colleagues. "No," I said, sensing by his tone that this was something important. You might want to take a break from charting, he said. Is this what I think it is? Just take a look and then come talk to me, he said. Before he could even shut the door, I was halfway through the abstract. I was only partway through the first page before I experienced a jolt of recognition. Here it was, the final puzzle piece that pulled all the others into place. Everything I had experienced in the past 10 years, all of those questions and observations that I couldn't quite put together, suddenly had a linchpin. With my heart knocking in my chest, I started to read aloud the particularly mind-blowing parts of the study, occasionally stopping to whisper-shout in Jamaican patois. The first thing that struck me about Felidi and Onda's research was how incredibly robust it was. They reported data from 17,421 people, which was a large enough number to provide the validation I'd never thought I'd find. When I finished reading the study, my excitement didn't diminish. I felt like Neo at the end of the movie, The Matrix, when suddenly the world was dripping with green numbers. Not only was I seeing the full reality of what was around me, but I understood it. According to the ACE study, I wasn't the only one making connections between the stress of childhood adversity and bad health outcomes. This piece of the puzzle, this final piece of code in the matrix, was just what I needed to make sense of what was going on with my patients and, more important, to treat them. At the time, I knew that this moment, this understanding, was going to profoundly change my practice. But I had no idea how much it would change my life. It was 1985 at the Kaiser Obesity Clinic in San Diego, and Dr. Vincent Felidi was interviewing his first patient of the day. If you were to stand behind Dr. Felidi in line for soup at the hospital cafeteria or glide past him in the hallway, you would probably be struck by his bearing. Stately, composed. These are the words you might use. Every bit the poised intellectual, with a head full of thick, white hair, he looked ready to host the news hour on public television or calmly moderate a debate between acrimonious politicians. He spoke with confidence and authority and was extremely articulate, which is why when he told me this story, I was blown away to discover that his biggest medical breakthrough had happened because of a verbal slip. Donna was a 53-year-old woman with debilitating diabetes and a significant weight problem. In a new weight loss program, she had successfully lost upwards of 100 pounds 2 years before, but in the past 6 months, she had put it all back on. Felidi felt a conflicting sense of frustration and responsibility. The truth was, he didn't really know why Donna had gone off the rails. She had been doing so well, and then, after all her hard work and success, she was right back where she started. Felidi was determined to get to the bottom of it. He rattled off a list of his usual preliminary questions. How much did you weigh when you were born? How much did you weigh when you started first grade? How much did you weigh when you entered high school? How old were you when you first became sexually active? But this time, he misspoke. Instead of asking, how old were you when you first became sexually active? He asked, how much did you weigh when you first became sexually active? 40 pounds, said Donna. Her answer stopped him short. Wait a minute. 40 pounds? He was pretty sure he'd heard her wrong, and for a minute, he didn't say anything. But then something made him ask the question again in the same way. Maybe she had meant 140 pounds. Sorry, Donna. How much did you weigh when you first became sexually active? She went quiet. He waited for her to speak, sensing there was something there. Working with patients for over 2 decades, had taught him that on the other side of a pregnant pause was usually some diagnostic gold. "I was 40 pounds, Donna said, looking down. Felitti waited, stunned. "It was when I was 4 years old, with my father," she said. Felitti told me that in that moment, he was shocked, but he struggled not to show his emotions. I know that feeling all too well. In 23 years of working with patients, he had never heard someone tell a story of sexual abuse during a checkup. Nowadays, that would be hard to believe. I wondered if it was because he'd never asked, or because it was the 80s, when stories of abuse were even more buried than they are today. When I asked him about it, Felitti said he thought he'd probably never asked. He was a doctor, after all, not a therapist. Weeks after speaking to Donna, Felitti interviewed another noncompliant patient who was part of the same weight loss program. Patty had actually started out as a model patient. In a jaw-dropping 51 weeks, she had gone from 408 to 132 pounds. Patty and Donna weren't alone. Many other patients were also experiencing great results, some losing up to 300 pounds in 1 year on the regimen. Felitti was excited by the outcomes, but the high dropout rate was puzzling. If it had been patients who were still early in the process, the attrition rate would have been understandable. After all, the fasting regimen they committed to was challenging. But the strange part was the dropout rate was highest among the most successful patients, the very ones who had stuck with it the longest and seen the best results. Just as they were reaching their ideal weights, when they should have been celebrating their hard-won goals, these successful patients suddenly disappeared. They would drop out of the program permanently, or leave and come back months later, having regained a majority of the weight they had lost. Felitti and his colleagues were left scratching their heads. They had found what seemed to be a solution for a notoriously intractable problem, yet it was proving unsustainable for no discernible reason. Felitti was meeting with Patty to try to understand what was going on. He could tell she was on the verge of dropping out of the program because in the past 3 weeks, she had regained 37 pounds. She was going the wrong way, fast. He hoped he could get her back on track before it was too late. He performed a physical examination on Patty to see if he could determine what was behind the sudden weight gain. Was her heart failing, causing her to retain large amounts of fluid? As far as Dr. Felitti could tell, she wasn't exhibiting the bloating or puffiness that indicated fluid retention associated with heart failure. Was her thyroid out of whack? He took a closer look at her hair, skin, and nails, but didn't observe any dryness or thinning, and her thyroid was a normal size. There didn't seem to be any physical signs of a metabolic problem. After checking everything off the list, Felitti sat down with her for a talk. "Patty, what do you think is going on here?" "You mean the weight?" "Yes." Her smile dimmed, and she looked down at her hands. "I think I'm sleep eating," she said sheepishly. "What do you mean?" Felitti asked. "When I was a kid, I used to be a sleepwalker. I haven't done that for years. But I live alone, and when I go to bed at night, everything is clean and put away in the kitchen. Now, when I wake up in the morning, the pots and dishes are dirty. The boxes and cans are open. Somebody has obviously been cooking and eating, but I can't remember any of it. Since I'm the only person there, and I'm putting on weight, I guess it's the only explanation." Felitti nodded. It seemed a little wacky, possibly even the sign of some sort of psychopathology. Ordinarily, he'd refer her to mental health services and focus his attention on addressing her physical health, but something stopped him. His recent conversation with Donna made him realize that there were things that might be affecting his patient's success that he wasn't getting at with his usual questioning. He decided to follow this thread, even though it seemed outside of his area of expertise. "Patty, that you're sleep eating explains the weight gain, but why are you doing it now?" "I don't know." "But why didn't this happen 3 years ago or 3 months ago?" "I don't know." Felitti tried again. His work in infectious disease and epidemiology wouldn't let him stop with the surface explanation. There was usually a trigger event. Cholera didn't affect so many people in the Soho neighborhood of London because of bad luck. There was something tying together all of the people who got sick, and that something was a contaminated well. Felitti doubted that Patty started sleep eating for no reason. "Think hard, Patty. What's been happening in your life? Why would you start sleep eating now?" She was quiet for a moment. "Well, I don't know if it's related, but there's this man at work," she said, looking down again. Felitti waited, and eventually, Patty went on to explain that in her job as a nurse at a convalescent home, she'd been in charge of a new patient who kept hitting on her. He was much older and married, and he had remarked on how good she looked now that she'd lost all that weight. He'd been propositioning her ever since. At first, Felitti was perplexed. It didn't totally line up that this rather mild harassment, it was the 80s after all, was enough to set her off in such an extreme way. But as he probed further, things became a lot more clear. Patty had a lengthy history of incest at the hands of her grandfather, starting when she was 10 years old. This was also when she had begun to struggle with her weight. After Patty left that day, Dr. Felitti realized that he couldn't ignore the similarities between her and Donna. Maybe it had just been a coincidence. But what stuck with him was the timing. Both patients had begun to gain weight as children, immediately subsequent to incidents of abuse. Fast forward a few decades, Patty's sudden weight gain coincided with being hit on by her patient. Felitti wondered if she might be subconsciously protecting herself from what must have seemed like a recurring trauma by gaining weight. What if he had been looking at this all wrong? He, as a doctor, had perceived a patient's weight to be the problem. What if it was actually a solution? What if his patient's weight was a psychological and emotional barrier, something protecting her from harm? That would go a long way towards explaining why his most successful patients, the ones who had peeled off that protective layer, were so desperate to put it back on. Felitti suspected that he might have glimpsed a hidden relationship between histories of abuse and obesity. To get a clearer picture of that potential relationship, when he conducted his normal checkups and patient interviews for the obesity program, he now began asking people if they had a history of childhood sexual abuse. To his shock, it seemed as if every other patient acknowledged such a history. At first, he thought there was no way this could be true. Wouldn't he have learned about this correlation in medical school? However, after 186 patients, he was becoming convinced. But in order to make sure that there wasn't something idiosyncratic about his group of patients, or about the way he asked the questions, he enlisted 5 colleagues to screen their next 100 weight patients for a history of abuse. When they turned up the same results, Felitti knew they had uncovered something big. Dr. Felitti's initial insight about the link between childhood adversity and health outcomes led to the landmark ACE study. This was a prime example of doctors thinking like detectives, following a hunch and then putting it through its scientific paces. Beginning with just two patients, this research would eventually become both the foundation and the inspiration for ongoing work, giving medical professionals critical insight into the lives of so many others. After the initial detective work within his own department, Felitti started trying to spread the word. In 1990, he presented his findings at a national obesity meeting in Atlanta and was roundly criticized by his peers. One physician in the audience insisted that patients' stories of abuse were fabrications meant to provide cover for their failed lives. Felitti reported that this man got a round of applause. There was at least one person at the conference who didn't think Dr. Felitti was being hoodwinked by his patients. An epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, David Williamson, was seated next to Felitti at a dinner for the speakers later that night. The senior scientist told Felitti that if what he was claiming, that there was a connection between childhood abuse and obesity, was true, it could be enormously important. But he pointed out that no one was going to believe evidence based on a mere 286 cases. What Felitti needed was a large-scale, epidemiologically sound study with thousands of people who came from a wide cross-section of the population, not just a subgroup in an obesity program. In the weeks following their meeting, Williamson introduced Felitti to a physician epidemiologist at the CDC, Robert Onda. Onda had spent years at the CDC researching the link between behavioral health and cardiovascular disease. For the next 2 years, Onda and Felitti would review the existing literature on the connection between abuse and obesity and figure out the best way to create a meaningful study. The aim was to identify two things. One, the relationship between exposure to abuse and or household dysfunction in childhood, and adult health risk behavior, alcoholism, smoking, severe obesity, and two, the relationship between exposure to abuse and or household dysfunctioning in childhood and disease. To do that, they would need comprehensive medical evaluations and health data from a large number of adults. Fortunately, part of the data they needed was already being collected every day at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego, where over 45,000 adults a year were getting comprehensive medical evaluations in the Health Appraisal Center. The medical evaluations amassed by Kaiser would be a treasure trove of important data for Felitti and Onda because they contain demographic information, previous diagnoses, family history, and current conditions or diseases each patient was dealing with. After 9 months of battling and finally gaining approval from the oversight committees for their ACE study protocol, Felitti and Onda were ready to go. Between 1995 and 1997, they asked 26,000 Kaiser members if they would help improve understanding of how childhood experiences affected health, and 17,421 of those Kaiser Health Plan members agreed to participate. A week after the first two visits for this process, Felitti and Onda sent each patient a questionnaire asking about childhood abuse and exposure to household dysfunction, as well as about current health risk factors like smoking, drug abuse, and exposure to sexually transmitted diseases. The questionnaire collected crucial information about what Felitti and Onda termed adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. Based on the prevalence of adversities they had seen in the obesity program, Felitti and Onda sorted their definitions of abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction into 10 specific categories of ACEs. Their goal was to determine each patient's level of exposure by asking if he or she had experienced any of the 10 categories before the age of 18. 1. Emotional abuse, recurrent. 2. Physical abuse, recurrent. 3. Sexual abuse, contact. 4. Physical neglect. 5. Emotional neglect. 6. Substance abuse in the household. For example, living with an alcoholic or a person with a substance abuse problem. 7. Mental illness in the household. For example, living with someone who suffered from depression or mental illness, or who had attempted suicide. 8. Mother treated violently. 9. Divorce or parental separation. 10. Criminal behavior in the household. For example, a household member going to prison. Each category of abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction experienced counted as 1 point. Because there were 10 categories, the highest possible ACE score was 10. Using the data from the medical evaluations and the questionnaires, Validi and Onda correlated the ACE scores with health risk behaviors and health outcomes. First, they discovered that ACEs are astonishingly common. 67% of the population had at least one category of ACE, and 12.6% had four or more categories of ACEs. Second, they found a dose-response relationship between ACEs and poor health outcomes, meaning that the higher a person's ACE score, the greater the risk to his or her health. For example, a person with four or more ACEs is twice as likely to develop heart disease and cancer, and 3.5 times as likely to develop chronic obstructive pulmonary disease as a person with zero ACEs. Given what I'd seen in my patients and in the community, I knew in my bones that this study was dead on. It was powerful evidence of the connection that I had seen clinically, but had never seen substantiated in the literature. After reading the ACE study, I was able to answer the question of whether there was a medical connection between the stress of childhood abuse and neglect and the bodily changes and damage that could last a lifetime. It seemed clear now that there was a dangerous exposure in the well at Bayview Hunters Point. It wasn't lead. It wasn't toxic waste. It wasn't even poverty per se. It was childhood adversity, and it was making people sick. One of the most revealing parts of the ACE study is not what it investigated, but who it investigated. Many people might look at Bayview Hunters Point and see the rates of poverty and violence and the lack of health care and say, of course those people are sicker. That makes sense. After all, that's what I learned in public health school. Poverty and lack of adequate health care are what really drives poor health outcomes, right? This is where the ACE study comes in and shakes things up, showing us that the dominant view is missing something big. Because where was the ACE study conducted? Bayview? Harlem? South Central Los Angeles? Nope. Try solidly middle-class San Diego. The original ACE study was done in a population that was 70% Caucasian, 70% college-educated. The study's participants, as patients of Kaiser, also had great health care. Over and over again, further studies about ACEs have validated the original findings. The body of research sparked by the ACE study makes it clear that adverse childhood experiences, in and of themselves, are a risk factor for many of the most common and serious diseases in the United States and worldwide, regardless of income or race or access to care. The ACE study is powerful for a lot of reasons, but a big one is that its focus goes beyond behavioral or mental health outcomes. The research wasn't conducted by a psychologist. It was conducted by 2 internal medicine doctors. Most people intuitively understand that there's a connection between trauma in childhood and risky behavior, like drinking too much, eating poorly, and smoking in adulthood. More on that later. But what most people don't recognize is that there's a connection between early life adversity and well-known killers like heart disease and cancer. Every day in clinic, I saw the way my patients' exposure to ACEs was taking a toll on their bodies. They may have been too young for heart disease, but I could certainly see the early signs in their high rates of obesity and asthma. Along with my excitement at finding the ACE study's demonstration of links between adversity and disease, came a wave of indignation. Why was I only hearing about this now? This study was clearly a game changer, yet I hadn't learned about it in med school, public health school, or even residency. Felitti and Onda published their initial ACE findings in 1998, and I didn't read them until 2008. 10 years. And still, this important science hadn't been translated into clinical tools I could use to improve my patients' health. How could that be possible? When I talked to Felitti years later, he mentioned attacks on parts of the paper by various colleagues. While Felitti and Onda successfully refuted the criticisms, the work never seemed to gain traction. In fact, it almost seemed to disappear, which is kind of crazy when you think about what the study revealed. Dr. Onda's colleagues at the Centers for Disease Control were agog, telling him that the magnitude of the increased likelihood of disease was a sort seen only a couple of times in a researcher's career. A critical piece of their findings was the dose-response relationship. For example, the more cigarettes you smoke and the more years you smoke them, the higher your odds of developing lung cancer. The ACE study strongly establishes a dose-response relationship, which is an important step towards demonstrating causality. A person with an ACE score of 7 or more has triple the lifetime odds of getting lung cancer and 3.5 times the odds of having ischemic heart disease, the number one killer in the United States. If a large study like Felitti and Onda's came out tomorrow saying that exposure to cottage cheese tripled your lifetime chances of cancer, the internet would break and the dairy lobby would hire a crisis management firm. So what gives? Why hadn't I heard of this study before? Why was I not listening to stories about it on NPR and watching Dr. Felitti be interviewed by Oprah? I can see now that there were at least 3 reasons. The first has to do with a misconception concerning the ACE study itself. The belief of some that the increased risk had everything to do with behavior. As I said earlier, many people assume that they understand the adversity-health connection. The popular thinking goes that if you live in poverty or have a rough childhood, you inevitably cope by drinking and smoking and doing other risky things that damage your health. But if you're smart and strong, you rise above what you were born and raised with and leave the bad things behind. At first, this construct seems to make sense. But remember, at one point, it made perfect sense that the Earth was flat. Fortunately, some smart scientists decided to test the behavioral assumption. They looked at the association between ACEs and heart disease and liver disease and did some very complicated analyses to see how much of the disease was due to the effects of health-damaging behaviors, like smoking, drinking, physical inactivity, and obesity. It turned out that bad behavior accounted for only about 50% of the increased likelihood for disease. In a way, that's good news, because it means that if a person is exposed to ACEs and he's careful to avoid smoking, physical inactivity, and other health-damaging behaviors, he can protect himself from about 50% of the health risk. But it also means that even if he doesn't engage in any health-damaging behavior, he's still more likely to develop heart or liver disease. Felitti's patient Patty is a good example. She was severely obese and a self-described sleep eater. So obviously, her behaviors caused her obesity, which caused her later health problems, right? Not so fast. After dropping out of Felitti's program initially, she returned later asking for more help with her weight problem. Over the years, she would lose the weight and put it back on over and over again, even after bariatric surgery. Sadly, Patty died at the age of 42 of pulmonary fibrosis, an autoimmune condition that damages the lung tissue and makes breathing difficult and eventually impossible. But obesity is not the cause of pulmonary fibrosis. Patty didn't smoke, and she had never been exposed to any known pulmonary toxins like asbestos. Having an ACE score of 2 or more doubles someone's lifetime risk of developing an autoimmune disease. Patty's ACEs were likely her biggest risk factor, yet neither she nor her doctors knew it. In the United States, the culture puts a lot of stock in personal responsibility. The lifestyle choices you make do have a huge impact on your health. So-called bad behavior does result in increased risk to your health, and there's no disputing that. But the ACE study shows us, yet again, that it's not the whole story. The second reason I hadn't heard of Felidi and Anna's work in medical school, and maybe the most potent, is that this is scary, emotional stuff. It's one thing to take a cold, calculating look at your cottage cheese consumption over the past decade, but it's another to revisit trauma and abuse. I bet everyone reading this book can think of someone who grew up with a family member who suffered from mental illness, or who had a parent who drank too much, or who was emotionally abusive, or who believed that sparing the rod spoiled the child. In any group you might find yourself in, a classroom, a professional conference, a wedding party, the U.S. Congress, if everyone's ACE score was suddenly revealed, it would show pretty clearly that this is an issue that touches many of us. But most of us don't like to think about the sad, upsetting things that have happened in the past. It's possible that we marginalize the impact of trauma on health because it does apply to us. It's hard, after all, to accept that there might be biological implications that persist whether people are sinners or saints. Maybe it's just easier to see it in other zip codes. The last reason why the ACE study didn't catch fire in the medical and scientific communities in 1998 can best be explained as scientific gaps. The study showed that adversity was bad for your health. But although Felidi and Anda had exposed the what, they were unable at the time to answer the how. Lucky for me, there had been 10 years of intervening research that had slowly but surely filled in those scientific gaps. Now what I needed to do was return to the Hayes Lab and Sarah P. and dig deeper into that how. In my gut, I had a strong sense of what puzzle pieces fit in the ACE study's scientific gaps. Identifying and demonstrating that the stress response system was the biological mechanism behind adversity's role in health was going to be the fun part. I'd have to jump back into those journals and hit up some medical conferences. But now I had the ACE study to guide me. I could use its language in my searches, interrogate its authors for clues, and even start collecting my own ACE data at the clinic. The realization that this was bigger than my patients, bigger than Bayview, made my heart pound. Adversity's detrimental impact on health had all the hallmarks of a public health crisis hidden in plain sight. Before I met Diego, or even knew about ACEs, I had hope for Bayview. I knew problems there were amplified, but that their solutions would be too. On the first day at the clinic, I told my staff that if we could successfully treat people there, we could treat people anywhere. Part 2. Diagnosis. Chapter 4. The Drive-By and the Bear. It was chilly, which was typical for a December night in San Francisco. But as I walk down Mission Street with my friends, I remember hugging myself to try and warm up. Home for the holidays.